from uptown. You know my sound is major. I know you like the lyrics, kid, so just do me a favor. Tell the tech to turn my dad up. This is a pack up. Hey, I don't back up, because I wanna dive in and swim in the mentals where your thoughts roam. I wanna make your dome my home before you never be alone. But when you hear my song, sing along with the rhythm, because I got big and fat beats that I get from. Yes, it's the ears, and I'm checking out the blunt one. Maybe I can have one, maybe I can turn one. Chill, I'm one with God, brothers. It's hard to stay straight until you're scared straight, and then you can't wait to get out. Then you shout, damn, I got freedom. Unless it's being taught, black man, I know you need one. The right time to make you free your mind.
Okay, welcome to Conscious TV with Tom and Ramon. How we doing tonight, Ramon?
We're doing pretty good, and good morning to those of you listening from my side of the world.
And good evening on this side. Tonight, I think we got a pretty well-known guest, don't we?
Yep, very well-known. Before we bring him on, let's just go ahead and give our website. You can check out what other guests we have coming up, and that's www.conscious-tv.com. So our next guest is a PhD author, explorer, electronics engineer, and physicist. He's one of the most successful pioneers with ground probing radar technology in the world. The technology is currently utilized in the Mars Express program. Agnews holds a bachelor's in chemistry, master's in statistics, and a doctorate in physics. Author of thousands of technical papers, booklets, and video documentaries, Dr. Agnew has joined with veteran archaeologist E.J. Clark to produce The Ark of Millions, Volume 1, 2, and 3. And also, he produced his latest book, Remembering the Future, which has hit number 4 in the self-help books, I believe it is. He can correct this. And hopefully, one of these days, he will also add on to that list, Astronaut. Let's bring on Dr. Brooks Agnew.
I like all that. Right. I like Astronaut. That's good. I'm just going to replace everything else with that. I like
it. So, Brooks, you have a lot of things under your belt. For those people who think, I don't have enough time, I don't have time to raise children and do what I want, you've proved them wrong with your life personally. I mean, I didn't even read everything you've done. I just read a small portion of it.
Well, yeah, I understand. Maybe it's a hopeless case of ADD. I don't know. But I think that a lot of people come into mortality and limit themselves. They start out when they're young and their imagination is going everywhere, and they make dreams to do everything, and their parents, their teachers, their peers begin to make them rational and make them give up those dreams. I asked a lady just the other day, what's your dream? And she said, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I said, you mean you forgot? Well, maybe, but I don't really have a dream. And I said, would you like to learn how to dream again? And it seems so foreign to her, like something she remembered doing in the third grade or something. And I see that happen with a lot of people. And maybe I just didn't listen to those rational thoughts. I kept dreaming. I learned to dream large, my friends. And I just kept following it. And even though I didn't make it to the peak of my dream, I was always, and still am today, doing what I want to do and being
what you call this not your peak? Wow. Scary to think we saw your peak.
not even close. Not even close.
Well, we haven't seen him walking on the moon yet, so.
Not yet. Not yet. I want to touch on a few things. Let's talk about the book. There's actually something that you and Tom have in common, and Tom, go ahead. Tell them.
Yeah, the story you related in the book about when you were, I think, were you 7 or 9 when you went on that fishing trip?
9.
Okay, same exact with me. I couldn't remember if it was 7 or 9. I was 9 years old, and I went back to South Dakota to visit my grandparents for the summer. And my uncle took me to a lake there called Sylvan Lake. It's a little tiny lake, maybe a 15, 20 acre lake. And it was opening day of trout season. And the banks were just absolutely lined with people. There had to have been 100 people out there fishing off the banks. There were no boats allowed on the lake. And fishing with a bobber and a worm. And threw my line in. It sat there for 15, 20 seconds. The bobber went down and I reeled it in. Had a nice 14, 16 inch rainbow trout.
Nice.
I did that 7 times in a row over a period of about, probably about 45 minutes. And this guy saw me, and nobody on the lake was catching anything. No one. This guy walked all the way around the lake. He saw me catching these fish, walked around and asked me, "Sonny, how are you catching all them fish?" And a 9-year-old kid, I looked at him and said, "Well, mister, first thing you do is you put the worm on the hook." So that's been a story that my uncle actually still tells that to people. You know, the first thing you got to do is put the worm on the hook. But
just serious as you could be. Well,
oh yeah.
I'm in an aluminum boat. I mean, a little 14-foot rowboat, you know, that you get on Lake Palomar. And we're out there. Gosh, there might be 30 boats, 40 boats out there. And this is a big lake, though. And we're just dropping our lines over the side, you know. My brother's in the bow, and my grandfather's in the stern, and I'm in the middle, and I'm dropping my line down. And I literally felt like I could hear the fish. I could hear them getting close to my line, and I just knew where to drop the line down to. And I hauled in 25 trout. They didn't catch any. And we switched poles. We switched sides of the boat. I mean, they were so frustrated. they stopped baiting my hooks for me. I had to bait my own hooks, which I didn't really like touching. I think we were putting worms or something on there nasty, but... I don't, you know, all I know is I hauled in a whole bunch of trout and they never took me fishing again.
So that kind of, was that the same year that you, it was 7 when you went on the camping trip then?
No, it was actually, that was probably, it was 7 when I caught the fish and it was 9. I know it was 9 when we went on the camping trip.
Oh, okay.
I know that year because I know the car we were in when we took that trip across the desert, and I know where we were living.
Well, you expand on that camping trip. That's actually a pretty amazing story in itself.
No, I've tried to go back, even in meditation, I've tried to go back and find out where that 8 hours went. For those of you that haven't read the book, I'm not going to give you all the details. You just have to buy the book. But missing 8 hours and at when the school year started in a couple of weeks after that, my whole ability to bring to bear whatever intelligence I had completely shifted. As you know, the fourth grade is really what separates, you know, the sheep from the goats, as it were, in elementary school. Third grade, you have a lot of kids that, maybe they had preschool or whatever, and that kind of shows up in first, second, and third grade. But in fourth grade, that's where you really start getting into reading on your own, reading out loud. You also get into mathematics and lots of repetition in doing mathematics, long division, things like that. And it's really the grade where elementary school students begin to stratify as far as their right. their ability. And boy, did I stratify. I mean, it was like I was such a discipline problem because I was so far ahead of other fourth graders.
So did you end up, you went through, did the classical 13-year school, or did they bump you ahead any?
They did not bump me ahead any. However, what happened was my half brother was 9 years older than I was, so he was already in college. And what I would do is go to elementary school during the day, and then he would take me to college after school, which was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And started out in the zoology lab, biology lab, you know, pinning bugs to a board or looking at microscopes or dissecting rat brains, things like this, things you don't do till you're in high school, and also playing with very, very basic computers, punch cards and things like that, and ended up a subject of, and in those days there was a lot of funding for child psychology and ESP and all kinds of clinical studies, because we were in the middle of the Cold War and they were looking for answers. And I ended up sort of a subject kid at Long Beach State University on ESP. And I went through a whole bunch of stuff. Some of the stuff I still remember pretty clearly. Picking cards, all kinds of telekinetic experiments. And I don't know what the results were, but I stayed there many, many months. So something must have been going right.
Wow. Do you think that you were maybe genetically altered during that missing time?
Well, I don't know. I've never had my genes tested, but I sure have, you know, undergone a lot of IQ tests by nature of my lack of conformity in my behavior, shall I say. And over the years, you know, the IQ just keeps going up and up and up, and my thirst for knowledge and my ability to retain it has gone up and up and up. And you know, gosh, after 2,000 books and, you know, reading everything I can get my hands on and constantly writing and speaking and lecturing and listening to lectures, I have no idea who, I mean, I'm sure there are people like me on Earth. I just haven't met too many of them. I realize something happened that day, and I've gone back many, many times in meditation and tried to find out what went on in that 8 hours, but I have not been able to break through.
Is it possible you can tell us a little bit about your past life? What was the name of the species?
Well, you can't say it with the human tongue. It's a series of clicks. I tried to make it one time because I can hear it in my head, but it comes out something like... let's see if I can even do it with my tongue. I can't even do it now. It's a series of clicks with the tongue, and it's done.
Sounds like dolphin.
Between two sets of teeth. Yeah, that's what somebody told me when I actually did the sound right. He said, wow, I heard a dolphin make that sound once. But it takes two sets of teeth and I guess, you know, linguistic practice at it, and I just don't have the practice. Now, I am told, although I have no independent proof of this other than several people reporting it, that I speak in my sleep, but I don't speak English. But I do speak the same language every time. And they can make out, you know, words and phrases, and they repeat them back to me, but I have no idea what they mean. And I've tried everything from Hopi to Romanian, everything I can get my hands on, and I can find bits and pieces of it in various languages on Earth, but no actual words or phrases that match up.
So you've done that all your whole life?
Yes, I did it even when I was a little kid after age 9. What happened was how I first became aware that I was doing it is my mother shaking me awake, asking me to stop talking because I'm keeping my sister awake, who's down the hall. Evidently, she went up and said, hey, he's doing it again, and, you know, come down. I have no idea that I'm even making noise, maybe snoring, but no, you're having a full conversation with somebody. And it's been going on my whole life.
Well, that'd be interesting to have you ever got into recorded or anything like that. It'd be interesting to get it to a linguist. And
you know, it's very strange about that. We've talked about that for, I'll bet, 30 years. We've talked about putting a Vox, you know, voice operated recording system next to the bed, or, and somehow we just never get around to it. And I'm not like that. I'm not a procrastinator. If I put my mind to something, I'm on it, you know, but for some reason we just have never followed through with this. I don't know why. I think we just need, you're about the 50th person that's asked me to do that. So I'm, because, you know, in the at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, you don't, you're not awake anyway, and you don't have the ability to record all night long and watch yourself. But, you know, I've had lots and lots of people report, even in when I was a scoutmaster, we'd be out in the woods with 18 boys and sleeping in separate tents, and they say, you know, you talked all night last night.
I was gonna say, as far as the species, do you know if they're still around or were they extinct?
That's a good question. I do know that they were space travelers, because we came from another planet to the planet where I resided in the book. And the reason we were there is the abilities of this race to be empathic. That is to say, to pick up on the true thoughts and be able to communicate telepathically with other races. And we were used as forward scouts and diplomats for planets that wanted to be mined by a much more aggressive race, that we were conscripts. When the movie Avatar came out, I went, wow, that is so along the lines of what went on. You know, we were not 12 feet tall, we were 7 feet tall, a few more vertebrae in the neck and the back, and 6 fingers and toes, and 2 rows of teeth, and 2 sets of vocal cords. But, you know, other than that, the story's very close, that we were conscribed or conscripted to go to this planet and work with the indigenous people to facilitate mining their raw materials. And of course, they got into a squabble with another race that came there to get the same wealth, and they ended up fighting it out. And believe it or not, the planet facilitated their mutual destruction. So they went home with their tail between their legs, and rather than us returning to our home world, which we had now been gone from most of our lives, we just stayed on this one planet with the indigenous people. And as I said in the book, I know my house very well. I know the patio that we had that overlooked the fjord, and the sunsets and sunrises were spectacular. And I went out one afternoon to enjoy the view, and I woke up in the body of a 9-year-old boy.
Wow, it's amazing. That species actually sounds to me a little bit like, I think they call them the tall whites.
Well, except the skin was golden. It was not white. It was really like almost oriental in its color, just light golden. In fact, the female species, the skin, the organ of skin, was so sensitive to the intention, the true intentions of others, that it would actually sparkle with the energy from another being as it washed over the skin. And really, really sensitive, some of the females would wear gloves and sleeves in order to protect themselves from, you know, the harmful intentions of others.
From the perverts?
Yeah.
But I wasn't there, Ramon.
From the New Yorkers.
Just kidding, like, just kidding.
So I guess those kind of girls you can't invite to a bar, huh?
Only if your intentions are pure.
No. Now that most bars I go to. Yeah, Tom, you were going to ask a question?
Well, yeah, let's shift gears a little bit. I want to one of the things that you're most well known for is that the internet, well, one of the things actually that first tipped me off to you in the first place was the Inner Earth expedition that you've been working on. What's going on with that? Anything new, or are things just still plodding along?
Well, still plodding along. I became part of the expedition team in 2005. I joined the team to help build the gyroscope system, which we were going to plot the curvature of the Earth and try to discover the oceanic depression, which is an ancient maritime legend of a place where sea level is not sea level. It's sort of where the ocean bowls down in like a giant valley 100 or 200 miles across. And ancient maritime records, logs, and manifests that showed ships sailing from the Old World to the New World, they used to sail in parallel, sometimes several in a line, for a couple reasons. One, security, so they keep each other in line in case, you know, they broke a mast or were attacked by pirates or something happened, somebody got sick. But also they sailed about 7 miles apart, so they wouldn't collide into each other should they run into a fog bank or something like that. But the logs record that even from the crow's nest, sometimes the other ship would disappear for several days at a time, even though they're sailing by sextant on course. And then suddenly come up out of the valley like magic and be right on course next to them again. Very, very strange effects. So I spoke to several retired Navy people, submarine people, and one retired admiral. And he said, oh, yes, yes, I'm familiar with that. This is a place where we theorize that gravity is very intense inside the Earth, and it pulls the ocean down lower than it does elsewhere. And it just changes the shape of the ocean. And I said, well, have you ever given the thought to the idea that maybe that might be a place where the gravity is low? And the gravity surrounding that area is actually pulling the ocean away from that spot, sort of like the moon does, you know, tugs on the ocean and moves it slightly around the Earth in a tidal sort of stretching tidal gravity movement. And he paused for a moment. He said, you know, that makes a lot of sense. Maybe they are areas in the Earth where the gravity's low. Now, if that's the case, it supports the idea that gravity does not center in the core of the Earth, but rather in the crust of the Earth. So that was the team that I was on, was to map that curvature and try to discover the oceanic depression. Then in 2006, I went to the ESETI conference for the first time, and this incredible meditative experience happened, which I record in the book. I have never done it in writing before or since, so readers will get, you know, as close to what actually happened that night as possible. And I received for the perhaps the first time I can remember in this,
a huge
load. Yeah, it's not me.
No, I got it taken care of.
Wait. That download was particularly moving to me and really opened me up. Here I am, a scientist, a statistician, ideal in facts, figures, whatever I can measure. In fact, my PhD is in advanced measurement systems. So I was a little like Nell in the movie Contact. I'd had this non-technical experience that was very overwhelming, and I didn't really know how to deal with it, so I went and talked to some experts who were luckily there, and they said, oh, Brooks, that's just a download. I said, what's a download? And, she explained it to me, and Angelica Whitecliffe, a good friend, and she said, well, probably what's going to happen is you're going to go everywhere that you've planned to go when you're on this North Pole Inner Earth expedition, and the captain's going to turn to you and say, where to now, Dr. Agnew? And you're going to know, because that's why the information was given to you. And I went, wow, that is really deep. So then Sunday rolls around. Monday morning, I get on a plane. I fly back to Kentucky. I pick up the phone a couple days later, and I call Rodney Clough, who's on the board of this expedition team. And he says, I don't know if we're going to go forward with this or not. I said, why, Rodney? What happened? He said, well, Stephen Curry died of brain cancer. I said, what? I just spoke to him in November. It's August. You mean he's dead? Yeah, he passed away very unexpectedly. He was the expedition leader. And without a leader, he said, I don't think we can go on. I just don't think we can do the expedition. And then he paused for a second. He said, would you serve as leader of the expedition? I said, call me back in an hour. So he called me back in an hour, and it was unanimous, a board decision. So I accepted. And that's when I realized that I'd been given the download a couple days before. So since then, of course, that was late 2006. It was impossible to raise the money to do an expedition in 2007. Stephen Curry's team had returned all the money to the tourists who had bought seats on the boat. There was about 12 or 13 of them. So we started over economically from ground zero. We started in 2007 to raise money to go in 2008. By the way, it's a $700,000 deposit on the boat the December before you leave. So, and there's only 100 spaces. So you put the numbers together, that's, you know, $7,000 per person that you've got to raise. Well, we wanted scientists on the boat. We didn't want tourists. You know any scientists that have $7,000 laying around? Not. They picked up the sparrows. So we had to start looking for grant money. We had to start looking for investors. We had to pitch an angle of the expedition that economically would make sense without compromising the spirit of the mission. And that was, let's do a documentary to end all documentaries. Come on, this is the greatest expedition in the history of the world. We're going to the bloody surface of the moon here. We're going somewhere nobody has ever been by sea and lived to tell about it. So it was a great plan. It was a great story. And 2008 was the worst economy we had seen in about 50 years. So 2008 was out. We couldn't even raise money in 2008. So we started in 2009 to raise money for 2010. And it has been a real struggle. Now, to make matters worse, there are only two ships capable of making this expedition. One is called the Arctica, and the other is called the Sevmorput. Both of them are Russian ships, both with the same shipping company, former military vessels, now used in civilian expeditions. They will be retired at the end of 2012. So we are now shooting for... We wanted to do a 2011 and a 2012, but we're now shooting for July of 2012. This will be the last expedition of either of these ships ever, and it'll be the only opportunity to pull this off, making it the rarest Arctic expedition ever, and it will never be duplicated. So this is where we're at. We're pitching it. We're trying to raise the money to do it. It's $2 million to pull off the expedition. It's about another $2 to $3 million to get the film produced in such a way that it can be released as a documentary that makes sense to people. And there's room in there for a 13-piece miniseries, a reality show. You want to see what happens to people 15 days at sea with 120-foot seas going through spiritual training every single day, like a conference at sea for 15 days. Yeah, it would be an amazing reality program.
Yep, that sounds like a good pitch. God, I hope this comes off. I would sure like to have a seat on the boat myself.
Tell me about it. So as far as referring to like books like Smoky God, which was written, what was it, 1920-something? I can't remember the exact date.
I read the book.
Did you find anything that gives him credit that this was a real story, or is it as people say that he was just nuts?
Well, you know, it's like a lot of stories that you read. There's the Smoky God. There's Etta Dorfa. There's the rumors of Admiral Byrd. I've looked at the actual mission of Admiral Byrd flying over the North Pole in 1926, the South Pole in 1929. Clearly an aviation hero, clearly a super patriot, served all the way through World War II, served in several efforts after World War II, and if the government asked him not to say anything about it, believe me, he never did. That being said, anybody that would have firsthand, really close to the ground knowledge of what's up there, he would be it. So we kind of throw all the personal testimony cases into one category, that of unsubstantiated testimony. What we're trying to do with this expedition is create independent, verifiable, repeatable, and redundant data that proves either that there's a vent in the sea floor that connects our ocean with an ocean inside our planet, or that there's a physical opening that we can fly over with a helicopter, that we can circle with a smaller boat, that we can get on film, and maybe, possibly, finally determine if there is intelligent life living inside the Earth or under the sea in that area, and whether they will make contact with us while we're there.
Well, remember, I told you at the conference last summer about that out-of-body experience I had going into the inner Earth. That was quite an experience where I sank through the, I went through the crust and emerged and went through a significant amount of water that was inside the Earth. And when I surfaced, I was able to see the interior curvature of the planet. And I could see in the distance a landmass that was had greens and brown tones, and then there, the sphere in the center, instead of being a solid sun-like object, it was like it was half ignited, like only half of it was lit. That one right there was an amazing experience for me, seeing that. And I mean, that I do the conscious, intentional out of body. And sometimes I slip into some really bizarre dream state type dimensions, where reality is as fickle as your mind is. And I've been trying to make heads or tails of what part of that experience was physical, what is actually here, or was it something created out of my mind, or maybe another dimension that we have here?
Well, a lot of that jives with hard data. One is that the Japanese recently released a paper where they've done several spectrographic analyses of the core of the Earth, and they have determined that it is an ultra dense, somewhere around 14.5 grams per cubic centimeter, which is pretty dense, iron crystalline core, and that it's all basically one molecule, all jammed together. And it's at somewhere between 5,000 and 6,000 degrees, which would make it almost white hot. It's not a fusion reaction like our sun, but it puts off a tremendous amount of thermal radiation in the visible range. So it appears like a sun. Now keep in mind, the interior of the Earth is not a vacuum. It's full of air. So that means it's full of clouds. And whatever sun or inner lit core might be there will be significantly obscured by clouds. And it could very well appear as though it's half lit. It could very well appear like a smoky sun or an amber twilight all the time. So, these reports make some sense.
Yeah, that's very possible. I never considered the cloud aspect that could be there.
Well, you know, our atmosphere is about 6 miles thick. At about 29,000 feet, we run out of breathable air. And that's a pretty thin atmosphere, but it keeps us alive and protected from solar radiation down here on the Earth. The atmosphere down there will be somewhere around 1,200 miles thick. So it's a lot of mass. I mean, you can't see the stars during the day because light is bouncing off all of the air molecules in our atmosphere, and so it obscures space. Sky appears blue to us, even in indirect sunlight. Down there, you've got 1,200 miles of atmosphere full of moisture, and you don't have a fusion reaction, you know, really bright out there, putting off UV radiation to cut through it. So it's gonna be a different kind of illumination.
Yep. So, anyways, I think we're going to shift gears one more time here. I think Ramon had something he wanted to get in here.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about your Egypt trip, which you just got back a week ago, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Or a little over a week. A
couple days before Thanksgiving. And actually, it was the China trip. We had originally planned an Egypt trip. A long time we had it planned, and we had some fans going with us and enthusiasts going with us. Unfortunately, we had John Riley with us because we were going to make a two-day jaunt to China to sign some agreements for the car company. And what turned into a much longer event, it actually lasted about 7 days from the 10th to the 17th. So we missed a significant part of the Egypt trip, but we arrived back in Alexandria and hooked back up with the group there. And then we continued. So the Egypt trip was about 3.5 days for us instead of 13 days like it should have been. But it was really intense. And we got to do some things that only about 100 people a month get to do in Egypt. And that is go inside the pyramid, the Great Pyramid on Giza, with cameras by ourselves.
Nice. Did you guys have a chance to do any meditation work or anything inside?
Yes, we did. We did about 2 hours of it, and we had access to the King's Chamber, the Queen's Chamber, and the pit below.
Oh, I'm drooling.
Wow.
So I did all three. Now, interesting, the photographs that we took in, this is a very, I won't say very steep, but it's probably 40 degrees anyway, and it's about 100 yards long. Now, you know, keep in mind that you're walking through a tunnel about the thickness of a 21 cubic foot refrigerator. So you're stooped over, holding onto two handrails. If you're not in good shape, you're not making it. I'll put it that way. Only three of us made it down there. You've got to go 100 yards down deep beneath the Queen's Chamber. You're probably 250 feet underneath the King's Chamber in the very basement of the pyramid. And then once you get down there, you got to get on your hands and knees and crawl through another tunnel about 20 yards long. And then you're in the pit. In the pit, there's a smaller tunnel down inside the pit that you lay on your back, literally, and crawl. You shimmy back in there. It's sort of like a long coffin, an open-ended coffin. Initiates, originally, would crawl down into this pit in absolute complete blackness. No light. And they would stay for 3 days. It was a death and resurrection initiation. And when they crawled out of that pit, they had faced all their fears in the base of the pyramid. Well, the three of us got to do that. Of course, not for 3 days in, you know, period, but for a significant amount of time in darkness. And it's quite an experience.
That initiatory process is a big factor that's missing in our world today, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Well, it was missing in their time, too. You know, only the very elite of the priests got to do this. It wasn't something that the main people got to do. And keep in mind, when the modern-day Egyptians walked into the valley, that pyramid was sitting there already. They had nothing to do with it. They couldn't even get into it. They had to figure out a way to get into that pyramid in order to utilize it. But pharaohs, being the man gods that they were, with unlimited resources at their disposal, obviously wanted one of their own. So they started copying them everywhere. And you can sure tell the difference between the original and the copies.
Yeah, I find it funny that they take that graffiti that's in the main chain, pyramid to proof that it was Khufu's. Is that right?
Yeah, that's ridiculous. Khufu didn't have anything to do with that. He was an insignificant pharaoh. And when you look at the scope of the engineering, forget about the design. Let's just look at the engineering and the logistics of building it. There is no way that any Egyptians of that time 3,000, 4,000, or even 5,000 BC could have mastered that. There's just no way. You had 25 to 50 ton granite blocks that were machined so finely you can't slip a piece of paper in between them, and they came from 1,000 miles away in the Sudan. And then you had anywhere from 1.5 ton to 10.5 ton red granite blocks that came from 300 miles in the opposite direction, and they didn't even have wheels. There's nothing I can do about that phone. We just have to let it ring until they give up.
The one thing about the pyramid is the Empire State Building sinks, what is it, half an inch or an inch every year, and in the 100 years that it's been up, it's synced more than the 5,000 years that the pyramid has been up.
What'd they say, the pyramids only settled a quarter inch or something like that?
Yeah, I think it's amazing. I talked with Robert Balval about this, and he's also an engineer. And besides the logistical problems of building it, there's the precision with which this building is laid out. It's within 2 arc seconds of being lined up with the star Sirius.
Wow.
That you couldn't do that with a theodolite. A theodolite is a very precise transit that's used to aim missiles. You could not line the pyramid up that close with an instrument that precise.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, they just got lucky.
Let's shift. We only have a few minutes left, so I want to get into your, if it's possible, get into your cars and speak about Vision sure. Motors, is it?
Yeah, Vision Motor Cars, visionmotorcars.com. Yes, I've been in the automotive business as a profession my whole life, and except for a couple of years, I retired in 2006. Built a biodiesel plant, made enough money off of it by completing the plant and selling the stock to start the electric car company. I always wanted to have high-efficiency automobiles anyway. The automotive industry wasn't going in the right direction as far as I was concerned. I think they're capable of 80, 90, even 120 miles per gallon, and they're just refused to do it. So we developed a drivetrain that is the highest torque electric drive, the most efficient electric drive on Earth, and it will go around 300 miles on the same money it takes you to buy 1 gallon of gas today. And it'll accelerate our little truck fast enough to do an 18-second quarter mile, which is about 3 seconds faster than a standard small pickup truck. It'll haul 1,000 pounds, 100 miles, and it only costs $25,000. That's before rebates. So we intend to go into production as quickly as we can. We have over 150,000 orders for this truck.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. So do you have a projected date yet, or because I want to get in on an order?
We went into production in November of 2009 in Kentucky. We opened a plant, started production, as part of our qualification for a Department of Energy grant, which they so highly publicized. In August of 2009, in complete, I'm going to say, deception and betrayal, the Department of Energy gave all that money to the major car makers. No money went to electric car makers, not a dime. So we had no choice but to close the plant. So it's sitting there with trucks and parts and tools and job interviews done, and no ability to run to fulfill the orders. So now we're looking for private investors to come together to get this company up and off the ground. I'm sitting with just a little over $2 billion worth of sales on my desk, and we would love to go into production.
Wow. A quick question about the car. I also saw one of the in North Carolina, there was a news, or South Carolina, where it showed you making deliveries on one of the trucks. And not only that, you had a solar panel on top of it.
That's right. Yeah, it's the only electric vehicle in the world that charges batteries using a solar panel.
How efficient is that?
Well, the panel is the most efficient on Earth. It's got the highest watt density of any panel made. It puts about 150 watts at full pack voltage into the batteries the entire time the sun is out. The delivery truck version, which has a little square van on the back, like just a miniature delivery truck, it puts almost 6 amps continuously into the battery at pack voltage as the sun is shining. Wow. We have simulated this on the racetrack, and this vehicle will go about 125 miles on a single charge.
Yeah, I saw your white knuckle car, and it's just gorgeous, and I can't believe how cheap it is.
Yeah, well, we have two. We have the commuter car, which is a futuristic aerodynamic two-seater, and then we have, it's called the Hopper, and then we have the Raven, which is sort of the Miata competitor, and it's a little retro. It goes 0 to 60 in 4.6 seconds. It has almost 400 pounds of torque, so it'll go as fast as you want to go.
Wow.
Yeah, that's really says something about our government and where they are putting their priorities for putting all that money back into the gas guzzlers.
Don't get me started there. It doesn't have anything to do with the gas guzzlers. It has to do with campaign contributions, and that's just a simple fact.
Yeah, yeah. The reality we happen to be living in right now.
Well, I hope WikiLeaks takes on the Department of Energy next.
Yeah, that would be refreshing.
So going back to that alien experience, for lack of a better term, to explain what got you started there and how did you actually...
An ad in the paper when I was going to school in North Dakota when I was stationed in the tropical paradise of Grand Forks Air Force Base. And I answered the ad and I signed up for Transcendental Meditation and I learned how to meditate that way. And I enjoyed it. It was good. It relaxed me. It helped me deal with, the forces of adolescence and not having any parents to guide you through that time. But it just didn't connect me with anything. And I did it off and on throughout my life. And it just seemed like there was something back there, some memory, some veil, some history that I just couldn't quite dig into. Even though, the abilities were coming through, the genealogy didn't fit. It just didn't come through.
Right.
And then in 2006, when I was re-exposed to meditation and the download came through, a few months later, I was introduced to Drunvala Melchizedek. I took the meditation. Then when I started doing that meditation, literally within days of getting it right, these dreams started. And, my whole life that I would meditate, I always woke up in the same place. When I went in, I woke up in this serene green meadow sitting on a white lawn chair, looking at the wind blow through the trees and across the grass, and it was very serene and very quiet, very nice mountain meadow kind of view. This time when I went in, I didn't wake up there. I woke up on the patio, and I woke up there many, many times, dozens and dozens, hundreds of times, always the same, more detail each time, venturing out further and further away from the patio, until miles literally all around this planet. I know the way the stars look. I know the way the planets look around it. I know the way the sunrise looks, the sunset looks. I know the village people, not the village people, but the people.
Right.
My wife on that planet, everything about it. And then that one day, always looking out of my eyes, looking at everything else, I don't know what overcame me, but I said, I want to look at myself. So I put my hand in front of my own face, and that's when I saw the six fingers, and I rolled my hand over and I looked at my wrist, and then I wanted to look at my face, so I looked down in the water and I saw my face and the hair and my size, and I remembered as clearly as though I'm looking in a mirror. And then it was then that I remembered everything about that life, and I brought it forward to this life.
Wow. Yeah, I haven't been able to in my projections. I haven't been able, and I don't know if I need to try to work on my lucid dreaming or what, but in my meditations or my projections, I haven't been able to really go into the same places whenever I want to.
When you take the classes, it's a little bit more than reading the book or even listening to the CD and going through the steps. When you take the classes, you will learn that you go to a launch place. For Drunvalo, it was this cave, and he had like this ceremonial fountain that he could stand in, and he would literally go down through the fountain and out into wherever he wanted to go from there. But you have a launch place, someplace familiar that you can orient yourself before you go out astrally traveling. And this is when it clicked for me.
I'm writing this down.
And
that's a good idea.
You know, that part in the book, that part in Homeworld, when I stuck that in the center of that chapter, literally, I wrestled with it. I took it out, and then I put it back in, and then I took it out. And then, you know, one night I just said, look, I'm a third of the way through this life. I'm already unemployable by nature of my disability. You know, having a too high of an IQ is just as disabling as anything else. What else am I going to do? I mean, why not just tell the truth? You never know what's going to happen. Maybe other people will resonate with it. Yeah. So I pulled the trigger and put it in print. So forget about me ever running for president.
Yeah. Found a, you definitely get a little bit alienated delving into these subjects in society today.
Well, you'd be surprised how many people I've spoken to that are mainstream that have read that and not made fun of it at all.
Yeah, they would always, a lot of people would tell you, you know, in quiet, like, oh yeah, because I've met a lot of journalists that would tell me about their experience. I'm like, well, why aren't you documenting any of this? And they, no, I respect my career too much. But in the quiet corners of a bar, they'll tell me the entire story.
Yeah, I wasn't so much talking about you being alienated. I'm talking about my experience. The things that I have gotten into and talk about around people. It's I get the laugh and the oh, you're chasing aliens again. I'll get the little snide comments. Oh, what are you doing this weekend? Going out alien hunting and stuff like that. It's amazing that the shallowness of people that are so wrapped up in this third density stuff. So anyways, I think we're about out of time here, Ramon and Brooks. Really appreciate you coming on, Brooks. We'll definitely have to do this again real soon because there's so much that we haven't touched on.
There's so much that we wanted to cover that we just didn't get to cover.
I appreciate it, Tom and Ramon. These are hard to put together, and I hope your listener base keeps on growing. You guys, your heart's in the right place, and it's a global community, and it's thirsty for free press, and you guys are doing it.
Well, that's what we Thank said. You. We decided we wanted to get our voice out there and talk to some people that we thought that had something to say. So here you are.
Before we go, Brooks, can you give us how people can get in contact with you? What time's your radio show?
Sure. Sunday evenings is X Squared Radio. It's xsquaredradio.com. That's the live session. You can be part of it. Call in, participate with some of the greatest guests from around the world. And if you are an archive listener, want to listen while you're at your workstation, you can subscribe at xsquaredradio.com. There's over 1,000 hours of archives there for you to listen to.
I'd also suggest anybody who really wants to expand their mind a bit to pick up some of those books. The Ark of Millions of Years series is fantastic. I've read them all. And this newest one, Remembering the Future, just blew me off my feet. That's fantastic piece of work. I love the meditation in the back of it. That was just awesome.
Well, you should pick up the audio CD because it really makes it come alive. I'm telling you, it's that meditation is the meditation for busy people. Let me tell you.
Yep, definitely. It's an easy one to work through, and once you done it a few times and have committed it to memory, it is amazing. So, anyways, well, I want to thank everybody for listening tonight, and you can check our website out, www.conscious-tv.com, and we keep a little news and blogs and little video links and all sorts of stuff there for you to check out.
And we're also on Facebook, so you can find us there and find out who's the next guest. And we'll definitely have to book Brooks soon, so look at the website and you can see when he'll be back on.
Excellent.
Okay, thank you. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
I've had to straight ahead the trend from uptown. You know my sound is major. I know you like the lyrics, kid, so just do me your favor. Tell the tech to turn my dad up. This is a fat cut. Hey, yo, don't back up. Because I wanna dive in and swim in the mentals where your thoughts roam. I wanna make your dome my home. Therefore, you'll never be alone. But when you hear my song, sing along with the rhythm. Cause I got faith in fat beats that I get from. Yes, it's the ears and I'm checking out the blonde one. Maybe I can have one. Maybe I can con one. Chill, I'm one with God. Brothers, it's hard to stay straight until you're scared straight and then you can't wait to get out. Then you shout, damn, I got freedom. Unless it's being taught, black man, I know you need one. The right time to make you free your mind. Wake up.